There are two subjects one's never supposed to introduce into the conversation at any polite dinner party. One is religion and the other is politics. I'm in trouble this morning because I intend to talk about both. I can only plead in mitigation that the passage that we have to study this morning from the Bible forces that indiscretion on me. Because Revelation 13 is all about religion and politics. Or to be a little bit more precise, it's all about the religion of politics. Because the Bible doesn't assess politics in the categories we are familiar with, the right and left, the conservative and socialist, the Republican and Democrat and the like. You don't find terms equivalent to that in the Bible. The Bible instead speaks of the spiritual alignment of political power. Politics is either for God or against him, he says. And it's the purpose of Revelation 13 to warn us that in the last days, that is that period of time between Jesus' first coming and his second coming, in the last days, we must expect periods when godless politics manifests itself in particularly vicious ways. That's what Revelation 13 is all about. We're going to look at it in three parts this morning. First, we're going to look at the characteristics of godless politics, as Revelation outlines them to us in verses 1 to 6. Then we're going to look at the techniques of godless politics, which we find mainly in verses 11 to 18. And then finally, we're going to look at what the Christian response to godless politics ought to be, according to John's book of Revelation view. So let's look first at the characteristics of these godless politics, which are going to characterize the last days. I saw a beast, says John, coming out of the sea. He had 10 horns and 7 heads with 10 crowns on his horns, and on each head a blasphemous name. Now it's important we read this chapter against the background of the rest of the New Testament, particularly what Paul has to say about civil government. Say a chapter like Romans 13. Because we learn in those other passages that government, civil government, does have a perfectly legitimate role to play. There is nothing necessarily dirty about politics. According to Paul in Romans 13, the purpose, the function of government is to reflect the just rule of God within human society. It's perfectly possible for government to exercise itself in a way that pleases God. For it is God who instituted civil authority, said Paul. He instituted it in order to maintain the moral law within a fallen world. Government, says Paul, is God's servant for the good of men. That's how it was meant to be, anyway, and that's how Paul himself proved it to be in his own experience on several occasions. Perhaps you remember in the book of Acts how he was occasionally rescued from the mob or from the false accusations of his Jewish opponents by the timely intervention of Roman justice. But Paul himself was perfectly well aware that that happy situation would not last forever. In one of his earliest letters, in Thessalonians, he speaks of a rebellion that's coming. The man of anarchy who will set himself up against God and his people before the end comes. Now John is simply describing for us here, within these strange apocalyptic symbols, which those of you who have been following this series will by now be familiar with, he is describing for us here that same personification of anti-Christian tyranny which Paul anticipated in that passage in Thessalonians. The early church often called it just the Antichrist. See how he describes him in verse 2. The beast I saw resembled a leopard, but had feet like those of a bear and a mouth like that of a lion. Strange zoological hybrid, then, isn't it? But as usual, John's bizarre imagery isn't meant to be visualized, but decoded. You see, way back in the Old Testament, Daniel had a vision very much like this. It was a vision not of one beast coming out of the sea, but of four. The first, he said, was like a lion. The second, like a bear. The third, like a leopard. And the fourth, he said, was a hideously powerful carnivore unlike any animal he'd ever seen. Now, it's quite clear from Daniel 7 that those four beasts represent successive world empires. That's Babylonia, Persia, Greek, Rome, something like that. What John has done, you see, in the case of his beast, is to fuse these four visions, these four symbolic animals of Daniel together, and to make of them one composite monster. Those who are familiar with apocalyptic language, therefore, would recognize that what John is saying here is the sum total of all the godless tyrannies the world has ever known, all fused into one picture. To John, no doubt, he represented Rome. To many Christians down through the ages, he's represented Islam or the papacy. Today, many people would identify the beast with communism. Well, the truth is, he is all these and more. Because the beast is the archetype of godless politics in every age. Notice whose image he bears. We're told he had seven heads and 10 crowns. Do you remember where we have come across seven heads and 10 horns and seven heads before? It's exactly the appearance of the dragon that we encountered back in chapter 12, 2 weeks ago. A dragon, you remember, whom John identified as the devil. Indeed, according to verse 1, it is that very same dragon who stands on the seashore beckoning this infernal colleague up from the abyss. And in verse 2, it is that very same dragon whom we're told empowers the beast with the authority that he wields. So the beast is government, all right. But this is not government reflecting the just rule of God, a la Romans 13. No, this is government in its demonic perversion. This is what government becomes when the devil gets his hand on it. Personal evil incarnate within structures of tyranny, the earthly manifestation of those spiritual principalities and powers that the New Testament tells us Christians must wrestle with. John provides us here with several characteristics of the beast. He tells us, for instance, that the beast, apparently anyway, is invincible. Look at verse 3. One of the heads of the beast seemed to have had a fatal wound, but the fatal wound had been healed. In other words, the beast seems to have an uncanny way of re-emerging, even when you think you've beaten him. For the Christians of the first century, this may well have called to mind the myth that Nero had never really committed suicide. He would one day return to the Roman Empire. Certainly the experience of the church in the early days of the church was that they seemed to get rid of one persecuting emperor only to quickly find another. Nero has scarcely gone before Domitian is on the throne and the persecutions go on and on and on. The beast is healed from the blow he seems to receive. To us in the 20th century, perhaps, it's a sobering commentary on the way that revolution seems so often to result in worse tyrannies than the ones they were intended to overthrow. We lose the Tsar to gain a Lenin. We lose the Kaiser to gain a Hitler. We overcome colonialist oppression only to experience Marxist oppression. In his book, The Darkness at Noon, Arthur Koestler relates the story of an old Bolshevik who fights the good fight of Marxism, only to find in the hour of victory that he himself is imprisoned as an enemy of the people. So it always is that, the story over and over again. The beast is smitten only to recover. He has demonic recuperative power. You can't defeat the beast by force of arms. The best you can achieve that way is a brief respite from his tyranny. But he'll be back, uglier than ever. Invincible, then. The first characteristic, John tells us. The second, surprisingly, is popularity. The whole world was astonished and followed the beast. Men worshipped the dragon because he'd given authority to the beast, and they also worshipped the beast and asked, who is like the beast? Who can make war against him? Now, I guess there's no greater political mirage than the illusion that somehow democracy is a cast iron barrier against the abuse of power. If it were, but unfortunately it's not so. You can't fool all the people all the time, said Lincoln. He underestimated the beast, he said. Who is like the beast? Who can make war against him? They cried. See, people are neither as astute nor as upright as our democratic idealism would have us believe. People are quite capable of voting the beast into power. They voted in Hitler, didn't they? One of the astonishing ironies of the 20th century is the way that our obsession with elections has legitimized the rule of tyrannical individuals and tyrannical parties who thereafter dignify their regimes with the title Democratic Republic. Now, the fact is, people admire might more than they admire righteousness. For we live in a fallen world. They will gladly worship Satan and his allies in exchange for military security. Who can make war against him? That's it, you see. People are much more afraid of the hydrogen bomb than they ever are of Satan. Much more concerned to save their skins and their souls. Yeah, he's popular, is the beast. But the most distinctive thing about him, the thing I want you to notice predominantly in this description of the beast that John gives us, is that he is totalitarian. Do you notice that word that occurs in verse 4 and also in verse 8? Men worshipped the beast. That's the clue to the beast's identity. A government can be mighty militarily and popular democratically without necessarily being demonic. Now, the characteristic of the beast that gives him away is the attitude of total obedience which he demands of his citizens. He is not satisfied that men should fear God and honour the king. He wants total and unconditional submission of the will. In a word, he wants worship. You know, it's possible to distinguish two quite distinct theories of government that flow right throughout history. On the one hand, there's what you might call the constitutional model of government. On this view, the state exists to serve the interests of the individual members of the state. And very often a constitution is drafted, defining the rights of those individuals, which the state must defend, and clearly expressing the limits of power, which in the nature of things the state must never exceed. Such a government sees itself as accountable in some way to a higher law than itself. It may not explicitly identify that law with the law of God, but it recognizes that it's not all-powerful. There are certain things which are ultra vires, beyond its power. It can't make arbitrary decrees. It can only govern in accordance with those principles of justice enshrined in the Constitution. At the risk of making some members of our congregation insufferably self-inflated, we have to admit that the United States is, I suppose, the clearest example of such a constitutional model of government. On the other hand, there's what you might call the totalitarian model of government. On this view, each citizen abdicates his individualistic goals for the superior good of society as a whole. It's as if the state is conceived as a living organism with a will of its own. In fact, Rousseau called it the general will. A will which legitimately overrules the private conscience of any individual within it. Now, such a government sees itself as absolute. It is above the law. Citizens of such a state may perform any kind of atrocity and yet be immune from moral responsibility, because they're simply following government orders, like the limbs of a body obeying the brain. Our constitution, said Hans Frank, is the will of the Führer. Fascism, said Mussolini, conceives of the state as an absolute in comparison with which all individuals or groups are relative. Now, at the risk of oversimplifying things, I'm prepared to argue that those two types of government that we can identify in history, constitutional and totalitarian, represent within political theory what Romans 13 and Revelation 13 represent within biblical theology. The government as God wills it, the government as Satan perverts it. If you look in the Old Testament, you can find an archetype of both. The archetype example of totalitarian government is Egypt, where Pharaoh was adored as God. His will was the will of God, and people were enslaved as a result. The archetype model of constitutional government in the Old Testament is Israel, set over against Pharaoh's Egypt. Israel's king, according to Deuteronomy, could make no laws at all. You know that? He had no statute-making power. All he was there to do was enforce the national constitution of which he was the custodian. That is the books of Moses. According to the Bible, you see, the issue of political liberty is not a case of monarchy versus democracy, of a privileged elite versus universal franchise, and that sort of thing. The way in which a government is selected is really minor importance, according to the Bible. The vital thing is how that government is perceived by the people. The mark of the beast is that he demands to be worshipped. Absolute power, answerable to no one but itself, the deified state. That's the beast. See what John writes in verse 5? The beast was given a mouth to utter proud words and blasphemies. He opened his mouth to blaspheme God and to slander his name and his dwelling place and those who live in heaven. There's no doubt John could see the Roman Empire here. Thought it was Julius Caesar who abolished the republican constitution of Rome and made it into an absolute dictatorship. And the emperors that followed him increasingly arrogated to themselves divine titles. Domitian, at the end of the first century, even went so far as to demand that men should address him as Dominus et Deus, Lord and God. Wonder John speaks of the beast uttering proud words and blasphemy. Just imagine how that went down with the Christian. But the beast, of course, doesn't have to use religious language in order to blaspheme. He doesn't have to call himself G-O-D in order to give expression to this deification of political power which he represents. So long as the obedience he receives is unquestioning and unconditional, so long as his authority is absolute, acknowledging no constitutional or moral limits, then what he calls himself is irrelevant, for he's playing God. That's what matters. The mark of the beast is that individuals surrender their private consciences to the will of the state. The question, of course, we want to ask is how on earth do people fall for it? Surely this kind of tyrannical system can only be sustained by the most vicious coercion. That's where John is very shrewd. Shrewd enough to realize that that is not so. People, in the main, voluntarily submit to the beast's authority. Even though he's the worst imperialist has ever been. Do you notice in verse 7? He was given authority over every tribe, people, language, and nation. No self-determination here for anybody. No room left for even a little bit of nationalism. And yet they voluntarily submit to it. No one who has seen the films of those adulating masses before Hitler in the 1930s can doubt the insight that John has here. But how is it done, eh? How is it done? And that brings us to the second half of the vision, which we've called the techniques of godless politics. The beast out of the earth. Look at verse 11. Then I saw another beast coming out of the earth. He had two horns like a lamb, but he spoke like a dragon. He exercised all the authority of the first beast on his behalf, and made the earth and its inhabitants worship the beast. That's important. Made the inhabitants of the earth worship the beast. If you look at chapter 19, verse 20, you'll find that this second beast is called the false prophet. And that is really the clue to his identity. If the first beast from the sea represents the totalitarian state, this beast from the earth represents the state religion that bolsters this regime and persuades men to yield their allegiance to it. No doubt to John's contemporaries, this meant the paraphernalia of the emperor cult, with its impressive priesthood and ceremonial and pagan hocus-pocus. A later generation of Protestant martyrs would identify it as Catholicism, a religion that kept the papacy in its position of unparalleled political influence, as of course it was in the Middle Ages. For us today, perhaps, it's rather more difficult to identify who this second beast is. For, of course, we've tried very hard, haven't we, in the last couple of centuries, to sever religion and politics. It was the desire for toleration that motivated it. Peace can only be maintained, we said, if we keep religion out of politics. So we tried. In America, they excluded it by law. Here in England, a sentimental attachment to tradition led us to retain the established church. But in typical British compromise, we made sure the bishops were consigned to a convenient corner of powerlessness called the House of Lords. Either way, what emerged in the last couple of centuries in the West is the secular state. Politics with no religious banner to wave. At least, that was the theory. That's what it was supposed to be. But of course, what has actually happened? It's not that religion has been banished from politics at all, but that new, godless, incognito religions have grown up to inform political enterprise instead. Humanism, socialism, fascism, Marxism, capitalism, these systems of thought may not use religious terminology, but they fulfill religious functions. They provide men with a worldview, with a value system. These, in the 20th century, are the ideological counterparts of that Roman official religion of John's day. These are the philosophies by which the false prophets of totalitarianism in the 20th century will seek to rationalize their tyrannies and commend their systems to men. I think you'll find that John gives us some interesting insights into the sort of techniques that the false prophet, whether he has an outwardly religious or an outwardly ideological form, always uses. The first is a deceptive public image. Look in verse 11. He had two horns like a lamb, but he spoke like a dragon. The ideology of the beast always has to work hard at its PR. It has to, if you're as ugly as the beast is. So he has a front man, you see. He looks harmless enough, respectable enough on the outside, like a lamb. It's what he says that's so pernicious. Doesn't that ring bells? There are plenty of books in the library of Cambridge University that fall slap bang into this category. Academic-looking, respectable books. What they say has led to totalitarianism, has led to the reign of the beast. A propaganda campaign, that's here too, isn't it? Look at verse 13. He performed great and miraculous signs, even causing fire to come down from heaven in full view of men. And because of the signs, he deceived the inhabitants of the earth. Yes, he's in on advertising too. An impressive display of power in an unsophisticated age. These may be supernatural wonders conjured by magic. In an age like ours, where supernatural power is usually disdained, The miracles of modern technology will no doubt take its place, but the purpose is always the same. To convince the public at large, by carefully staged advertising stunts, that the beast can deliver the goods. He can solve the energy crisis. He can equip the army and defend us against the nuclear menace. He can revive the economy. Whatever you want done, he can do it. The beast is omnipotent. Vote for the beast. And there's a third thing, too, I notice here. The cult of personality. Do you notice that in verses 14 and 15? He ordered them to set up an image in honour of the beast who was wounded by the sword and yet lived. He was given power to give breath to the image of the first beast so that it could speak. One of the most fascinating features of totalitarian government is that it always seems to need a face. People can't worship a political theory. When a political party wants to gain total and unconditional obeisance from a people, it must have a charismatic leader to stand out front. In the Roman Empire, they did this by making statues of the emperor and leaving them all over the place, as our archaeologists find. More recently, of course, it's been those gigantic wall posters, like those of Stalin and Lenin and Marx, that adorn Red Square. Nowadays, of course, it's television, isn't it? Oh, yes, the leader must be good on the box. Because now the beast's image can come alive and talk to the people, even in their own homes. Never before has the false prophet had access to such intimate and effective methods of propagating the personality cult of the beast. It's almost irresistible. But of course, some people do resist it. Some people aren't fooled by the propaganda. Some people don't submit to the brainwashing of the media. For them, the old-fashioned techniques are still available, cruder maybe, but nevertheless effective. Verse 15. He caused all who refused to worship the image to be killed. The reign of terror. Once failure to conform to political orthodoxy becomes a capital offence, then you really know the beast is in the driving seat. Or there's the old starve them into submission technique. Verse 16. He also forced everyone, small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on his right hand or on his forehead, so that no one could buy or sell unless he had the mark. Personally, I think of all the characteristics of the ideology and techniques of the beast. This is perhaps the most disconcerting to us in the West today. Because, of course, what John is describing there in verses 16 and 17 is the bureaucratic control of the economy, isn't it? The beast not only holds the reins of political and military might, he monopolizes the marketplace, too. I sometimes wonder if socialists, in their mad rush to nationalize everything and centralize economic power, really understand what a beast they may be creating. With the best will in the world. I sometimes wonder if capitalists, with their vast corporations, always growing, always on about mergers and takeovers and the like, I wonder if they realize what a beast they are creating. All in the interests of profitability, of course. I wonder if modern governments, with their huge computers processing men and women by social security numbers and income tax numbers and the like, realize how many people are being controlled today. No one may buy or sell without the mark of the beast. Yes, without their trading license and their union card, they can't even earn their daily bread. We're not necessarily talking about something remote from our experience here.
We're not talking about something that only was true of fascist Germany or Marxist Russia. This Leviathan is growing even within our our famous structure of constitutional government, isn't it? The dehumanizing tyranny of capitalist big business politics and the paternalistic tyranny of socialistic big brother politics. This is the beginnings of the beast's techniques. Big is beautiful, he says. Till he turns men into the pawns of his economic planning and his scientific theories of management. Way back in the 50s, the Hoover Report commented on the United States. Whether the citizen realizes it or not, the government in one form or another accompanies the American citizen as an uninvited guest almost everywhere he goes and almost everything he does. Wright Mills wrote a book, an influential book, called The Power Elite, where he showed that even in the so-called democratic egalitarian societies of the West, power is often monopolized by a very small caucus of people at the top of the social ladder. These things are all the beginnings of the beast. The situation is no different in our country today. It is the cunning and the subtlety of the false prophet that he always makes us think it's the other people who've got a problem with totalitarianism, not us. Oh, the beast is the red menace, yes. Sometimes in my worst nightmares, I imagine this beast coloured blue. For there is a totalitarianism of the right as well as of the left, and it's very appealing to Christians, especially dogmatic Calvinists. You don't believe me? Look at South Africa. What an awful thing if the beast were voted into power by the moral majority. But it's not impossible. Now, don't jump to conclusions that these godless politics only exist in the Eastern Bloc and in the Third World. The beast may be a lot closer than you think. The false ideology that convinces men of his right to rule far more impregnated into our subconscious minds than we dare to admit. And that brings us to the third thing I want us to look at from this chapter. The Christian response to godless politics. Look at verses 7 to 10. He was given power to make war against the saints and to conquer them. All the inhabitants of the earth will worship the beast, all whose names have not been written in the book of life, belonging to the Lamb that was slain from the creation of the world. He who has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is to go into captivity he will go. If anyone is to be killed with the sword he will be killed. This calls for patient endurance and faithfulness on the part of the saints. I mentioned earlier that one of the characteristics of the West in the last couple of centuries has been this attempt to separate religion and politics in the name of toleration. Most of us, I guess, have imbibed that idea with our mother's milk. That's why we find it so difficult to understand Khomeini in Iran or Paisley in Northern Ireland. It seems so incomprehensibly unenlightened to us, doesn't it? So reactionary. To make a political issue out of religious preferences. Why can't they just live and let live, we say? Well, without wishing to endorse either Khomeini or Paisley, I have to say to you this morning that it is not quite as simple as that, is it? It may be very convenient to keep religion and politics in watertight compartments, and some religions may be content with such an arrangement. But for some religions, such an arrangement is impossible. And Christianity is one of them. Christianity can't possibly acquiesce to being denied the ability to comment on political situations, political regimes. The reason is quite simple. The fundamental tenet of the Christian faith is that Jesus Christ is Lord. Not Jesus Christ is my Lord. That's true, but that is not the creed. Jesus Christ is my Lord would mean that his dominion were restricted to the private lives of Christian believers. But that is not what Christians confess. They say Jesus Christ is Lord, unqualified and universal, the King of everything and everybody. If men are ignorant of his rule, they must be told. That's evangelism. If men reject his rule, they must face the consequences. That is judgment. And there is no way, I suggest, that such a creed can avoid having political implications. In particular, it is impossible, it seems to me, for any Christian to surrender to totalitarianism without denying to Christ that proper authority within the civil sphere which his confession of the lordship of Jesus demands. That's why the Roman Empire persecuted the Christians. Because they would not say, Caesar is Lord, and insisted on saying instead, Jesus is Lord. That's why the beast always persecutes the church. If Christianity were a religion that could keep its nose out of politics, it would be quite safe. But it can't. Not if it's true to its creed. Authentic Christianity must be a politically aware religion. For though all others may surrender their will to the totalitarian state, the Christian cannot. He knows the rule of the beast is illegitimate. Oddly enough, I suspect that that is the significance of this strange number 666. No, I hadn't forgotten about it. Though in many ways I wish I could. Enormous quantities of ink have been spent on this number, trying to work out what it means, and most of them have assumed that it has something to do with what's called gematria, that is, the idea of giving a numerical value to a name. For in Greek, the characters of the Greek alphabet function not only as letters, but also as numbers, so that any number, any word could be added up and you could assign a number to it. There's an interesting example found in the graffiti on the walls of Pompeii, where some young lover has written, I love her whose number is 545. No, they didn't have telephones in Pompeii. That's the number of her name. So much more romantic, don't you think, than initials, and much more intriguing. So is 666 some cryptic representation of the name of one of the Roman emperors, like Nero, for instance? A lot of people say it is. Unfortunately, the arithmetic only works if you translate Nero's titles into Hebrew and misspell them. So that isn't terribly convincing. Those who consign all these prophecies and revelation to the distant future, of course, will say that this is one of those mysterious things we'll only know when the time comes. Perhaps the beast will occupy room 666 in the Jerusalem Hilton. I had one suggestion once made to me that if you write 666 in a particular way, you can actually create a hammer and sickle out of it. All kinds of theories have been suggested. But my opinion, for what it's worth, is that this isn't strictly an example of gematria at all. Neither is it literal. It's a symbolic number. You see, according to gematria, the name of Jesus totals 888. And this was well known in the first century. In fact, we can find in one of the apocalyptic books that John would almost certainly have known about a reference to precisely this. It may well have been a code for the name of Jesus within the circle of John's persecuted friends. And if that's so, then perhaps the number of the beast, 666, is simply a comment to those who are in the know on the inferiority of the beast to Jesus. He's not 888, he's not even 777, he's 666. In other words, it's a kind of apocalyptic way of blowing a raspberry at the beast. This is the number of a man, says John, not the number of a saviour. He's 666. Well, that's my theory. Whether it's right or not, I've got no doubt about this, that John's primary purpose in writing this chapter is to make Christians aware of the political implications, the spiritual implications, rather, of the politics of their day. You must recognize the beast, he's saying, and you must stand against him. You can't separate religion from politics. You can't consign your Christianity to some little orbit of personal freedom called my private life. You can't do it. You must identify yourself publicly as one who does not wear the mark of the beast, but rather wears the seal of God's elect, whose name is in the book of life that belongs to the Lamb. And you do that by refusing to worship the beast. That's how you do it. You refuse to worship the beast. Notice he doesn't say you take up arms against the emperor. That may very well be explicitly what he's saying in verse 10, because one reading of the Greek at the end of verse 10 says, if anyone kills with the sword he will be killed. So it may very well be a reference to the non-violent strategy of Jesus to his disciples just before the cross. But John certainly does not tell the church to take up arms against the beast. Neither does he tell them to form an opposition political party. It's always tempting, of course, to do things like this, to try to improve the political situation by taking a measure of civil power to the church. But whenever the church has identified itself with some particular political goals in that way, it has always been disastrous through history. That's where it seems to me Paisley is wrong, and where the moral majority are in danger of going wrong, of identifying the church with a particular political program and party. No, the state, at its best, is always a spiritually ambiguous institution. Any liaison between church and state is likely to become an unholy alliance in which the church corrupts herself and thus becomes the false prophet of the beast. We argue that it's happened in history. But if the church can't take up arms or become a political party, what can she do? Says John, she can suffer. That's a hard saying, isn't it? But that's what he's saying. She can suffer. For to refuse to worship the beast is civil disobedience. It's a treasonable offense in this totalitarian regime. Yet there are times, says John, when the only place a Christian can retain his integrity is either in prison or on the scaffold. If anyone is to go into captivity he will go. If anyone is to be killed with the sword he will be killed. And it's by enduring this suffering, says John, that the church must make her stand in the days of the beast. I want you to notice that this is not a pacifist ploy. This is not a kind of moral blackmail, such as Gandhi advocated, for instance. The suffering of the church is not a political strategy. It's a spiritual witness. Yet, of course, there can be no doubt that such a witness has had effects in history. The Roman Empire was right to fear the growing Christian minority. The Kremlin is right to be anxious about the growing number of believers in Russia. Not because Christians have any political program or any military muscle to wield, but simply because the confession, Jesus Christ is Lord, exposes to public gaze the illegitimacy of the beast. It calls to men's consciences. It reminds them of what deep in their hearts they always know, that there is only one who rightly demands their worship, and that is God. Never the state. That confession, Jesus Christ is Lord, is the truth. That is the one thing the liar fears more than anything. But of course it takes nerve, doesn't it? It takes nerve when all else are worshipping the beast to say no and face the consequences. This calls for patient endurance and faithfulness on the part of the saints. I guess there never has been a more embarrassing failure on the part of the church in this century than the silence of the churches in Germany in the days of Hitler's rise to power. Doesn't it embarrass you? Apart from one or two brave souls? The church that under Luther had resisted the tyranny of the Pope, why did it capitulate to the tyranny of Nazism? The answer, I'm afraid, is that their nerve had failed. For some, Christianity had degenerated into a mere orgy of religious sentimentality. For others, the divine authority of Christ had been eroded by critical theories of the Bible. At best, Christianity in the 1930s in Germany had retreated into pietism. At worst, it had surrendered to skepticism. It was not the virile, red-blooded Christianity of the early church that cooperated so meekly with Nazism, but an effeminate and anemic weakling. And that's why the beast took power almost unopposed by the Christians. My great fear is that it could happen just the same today in our society. An American politician called Curran once said that the condition upon which God hath given liberty to man is eternal vigilance. Well, who ought to be more vigilant? Who ought to be more conscious of the invasions of Satan's totalitarian, menacing ploys than the church? Church militant.